Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Ingrid Ruthig. As part of our celebration of Poetry Month this year, we continue to visit with poets connected with our region. We find out about what and why they write, perhaps get a glimpse into their creative lives, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. We're very pleased to have Ingrid with us today. Welcome, Ingrid.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Ingrid Ruthig is a writer, poet, literary editor, artist, and former architect. Her work has appeared widely in Canada and abroad in The Best Canadian Poetry in English, The Malahat Review, National Post, Canadian Notes and Queries, and many other publications. Ingrid won a British Petra Kenny Prize for her poetry and the Eden Mills Writers' Festival Literary Competition. She also co-edited, co-published the Canadian literary journal Lichen Arts and Letters Preview for 8 years and was an associate editor for Northern Poetry Review. She is the author of Synesthete 2 and Slipstream, an editor of the books Richard Outram, Essays on His Works, and The Essential Anne Wilkinson. Her award-winning text works, a visual art fusion of word and image, have been shown in galleries and other public venues. A book-length collection of Ingrid's poems has been published this spring by FitzHenry and Whiteside. That's certainly a varied bio, Ingrid, from architecture to poetry, publishing, editing, and essays. How did you come to the literary life and to focus on poetry?
Well, it might seem like a bit of a convoluted route, but when I look back on it, I think there was always a love for me of literature and language and books. And though I was practicing architecture, there was always a continuation of using language. And I got back into reading after university. And then later on, after I had our second daughter, I was at home with her and I started to write. And I knew a couple of writers in the States at the time, and they kind of egged me on. They said, you should be doing this. And I thought, well, yes, but how serious am I? So I came to a point where I was thinking, yeah, I think I want to do this. Things changed. I ended up retiring from the profession after I'd started to publish, and it just went from there. It was a little odd, actually. But the poetry came out of the fact that I'd actually taken a stab at writing two novels. I started with fiction.
Uh-huh.
And I'd started two novels. I got quite a ways into them, but I felt like, A, I didn't really know what it was I wanted to write or how I wanted to write, and I knew I didn't have all the tools yet. So I started to go to workshops and joined up with a few local writers, and suddenly I fell into poetry. And that was even stranger because I wouldn't at that time have said I was a big lover of poetry, but it forces you to be precise with the language. You really have to work at it, but you can also dip in and out of it. So I could be minding the kids or going off to the school or picking them up or whatever it happened to be, and the next thing I could be dipping back into whatever poem I was working on at the time. It forces you to concentrate. Novels are much more like a long-term affair.
True. In 2011, you edited and contributed to a book on the late Canadian poet Richard Outram, who lived here in Port Hope for a time. Richard Outram aimed for precision and concision in his work. You've said it is part of poetry's appeal for you, precision and concision. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure. I have a tendency to think in tangents. There's always a number of different things going on at the same time. I make connections, and it's all a little bit chaotic in my head. And poetry, when you start to focus on some idea or some image or something, it forces you to be precise with the language. It forces you to distill those things and really hone in on something, to pay attention to each word. It's amazing how a few words can create a really powerful image or an emotion, and I find that it's a challenge to take language to that higher level.
Many people think poetry is difficult to read. They say they just don't get it. How do you respond to someone when you hear them say that?
Well, I understand the sentiment. I can empathize with that. I sometimes wonder where that comes from, whether it's a self-perpetuating dislike that people pass along in high school or comes of having to pick apart poems in high school, although I didn't do that. Oddly enough, it seems that the English program we had in high school was largely focused on fiction, very good fiction, and plays. Having said that, I think there are a lot of people that they've been forced to peel the layers apart, and they just don't understand where it's going to, and I think they have to get it. They've been told they have to get it, and they don't. So my feeling is, who said you had to? I'm more inclined to say, let the language play over you. Maybe you grab an image or an atmosphere. Maybe there's just a feeling that comes out of it. But if the piece, if the language, if the words make a connection on any level, if it disturbs something that was latent or you never would have thought of, I think then the poem's done its job. It would be nice to see more people open to that.
Yes, I think people are afraid they won't understand, and as you say, a great pity.
Well, it does demand a little bit more from the reader.
You once said in an interview that the creative process for me is like stepping into a canoe and choosing a direction as I start to paddle. Then the current takes over. What did you mean by that?
The things that spark a poem, or that spark me to write anything, quite frankly, they're usually an unexpected thing. It might be a memory, it might be a moment that you happen to be a part of, or it might be an image that sets things off. But when I sit down to start to write, I have a sense of where I'm beginning. I have a sense of direction. I know where I think I'm going to take it. But I find it's always a discovery. Where I end up is completely not where I thought I was going to end up. That's what I call the current. You give yourself over to the process of creating something, and it really doesn't matter whether you're working in language or music or visual art. You begin somewhere. You have something that has taken you to the point where you want to do something with it. You want to make something. And then you get into that canoe, and that's your vehicle. But the thing that controls where you're heading is beyond your control. So you just have to give over and trust to the process. And I always find it, that part, that exploration, is the most interesting bit, because I'm always surprised at where I end up, and it's usually a far better place than I thought I was going to. It's fun.
So, would you please read to us?
Absolutely. I thought I would read three poems that illustrate a little bit of what I was saying about the different things that set off a piece of writing. The first poem is a photograph. The second one was based on a moment. And the third one is set in a place. The first one is called Place de Rennes. After a photograph of the train accident at Gare Montparnasse, Paris, October 1889, in which the only person killed was the news vendor's wife. Today does not begin well. At breakfast, the children dish out their grievances. My egg is too hard. The butter's all soft. The younger spills milk and wails for a ball the dog's chawing on. Cat coughs a mess on the rug, and husband's running late for work. Yet he has time to alter my day. Marie, I'll need your help at 3. Then plant a kiss fast on my cheek. And so after I straighten the beds, plan ahead for supper, sneak a quick cup with the neighbor who minds the boys, I walk to La Place in peace. The sun slipped behind clouds hung heavy as linen when there is no breeze, though for the season it's warm, and somewhere close by a train's whistle, high and insistent. I've never traveled by train, spent my life in this city, though friends claim I won't have lived till I see the sun on Sancerre's vines and the houses of Rocamadour clinging to its riverside cliffs or waded in seawash along the coast. That damned whistle again. When I arrive at the stand, still trying to tell myself I've no desire to roam, my husband speeds off on an errand, leaving me to mind his newspapers, the pamphlets, pigeons, and passers-by. I picture those places, the beach and a soothing warm sea, hear the screech of gulls, 100 breakers drumming, the crash as waves roll heavy to an end, conjure in an instant, black billowed heavens come tumbling, convinced now I've seen it all.
Thank you.
New Year. Managed to miss it, That singular split second another year, now elderly and roasted by the new, yielded to the heave, a moment's end. We got distracted, were too late by the time we leaned in to hear. Yet desperate, hoped it still might dispense last wishes in our ear. But no. We scrambled then to recover our mistake, poked at remote keys, argued over telecasts and recourse, couldn't find the right time zone, Newfoundland all over again. We'd blown it. We raced for the doors, nearly unhinged in our haste to hurl them open, hail the air, only to fail anyway. Out there, nightbound, ellipses of snow lit on indifferent ground, and melting expired before we could take it all in. Vigil. A far cry from the earlier wordy buzz of the gala literary spectacle. Only bottles linger late night in the swish club lounge. I weigh in as lone spectator, dispirited. The sparkling wit went flat hours ago, banter dried up with the lime slices, and as it turns out, the faux stone newels dumb as a stump. Scuffed black coffin, the piano sags bereft of a body for purpose, and the backless, leggy metal chairs refuse to fall into line without arses aboard. Club chairs, wingbacks, and velveteen sofas cluster wordless in covert conversations. The bar's a merry celeste of vacant tables, abandoned glasses, and bowls hinting at what went on here. Yet mirrors reveal in spotty silver that not a single ghost hovers within reach. Not even artwork on the walls speaks a word, and the stairs usher none to relieve this disenchanted vigil of mine. Truth is, I'm brooding on the way hapless poets brave the reception with smiles. We stood polite a while, foolish by ourselves, then disbanded and drifted. Who thought a lofty occasion might keep the work afloat? Even now, with the lights on, a cold current of air sinks gloomy from the ceiling fans. Across the room, with its eye-searing blue, the frozen computer signals fierce intent. Shutting down your terminal. Please wait.
Thank you very, very much. Now we'll take a short break.